You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
I wasn't really looking towards literary models. I was interested in the way we create stories, but we're also created by stories.
The following event was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their elders past and present as the custodians of the world's oldest continuous living culture. Today on the Wheeler Centre podcast, Booker Prize-winning author Richard Flanagan discusses his hypnotic and genre-bending new book, Question 7, in a captivating conversation with host Astrid Edwards.
It is an absolute delight to be here with you. Congratulations on Question 7. I find myself struggling to adequately describe Question 7. So what's kind of an unusual step, I want you, before we begin to discuss Question 7, I'd like to know the literary influences, because this is a text so loaded with previous writers and texts and artists.
First of all, I should say it's lovely to be here with you, Astrid, and thank you all for coming. I'm a little more nervous than I normally would be because my beautiful daughter Eliza is here tonight, and I know she'll hold me to a high bar after if I say anything foolish.
Hello, Eliza.
Your question was about literary influences. I think perhaps, you know, that's the library of a life in two ways. It is all the books I've read, but more than that, it was about trying to describe a lost world and trying to find a way of describing that. And in that, I wasn't really looking towards literary models. I was interested in the way we create stories, but we're also created by stories. I was very conscious that during COVID, I realised that the world I'd grown up in and taken for granted, the material world of plants and animals and birds and fishes and so on, had ceased to exist, and along with it, a world of values I'd always taken as permanent, that too had vanished. And that vanished in this vast revolution that is so huge and so overwhelming that we don't even have a word for it. But everything has changed fundamentally in the last few decades. And we live now in the strange autumn of things. And I wanted to describe what the world was like before that revolution, and also about the values that people once had. Not so much social values, but the way they related to each other and also to the earth itself. So it was trying to recover all those sorts of things. And in that, Orwell once said that the hardest thing to describe is what's in front of your nose. And similarly for me, it was actually trying to abandon ideas of literary influences and trying to just write as simply and as clearly as I could. And I'd had a health scare. I wasn't sure if I would be able to write another book, or if I wrote one, how it needed to be a short book. And I wanted to ask a lot of questions in this book about things that concern me. So I was searching for a form that I could do that. And I always loved those artists like Matisse and that, who in their final years went to something fundamental, just shapes, forms, colours, and created things that were beautiful and comforting. And I wanted to try and do something similar. And I wanted not to try and emulate things I'd written in the past or read in the past, but to create a book of lightness. And I started taking things out. And the more I took out, the lighter the book became. Strangely, the more there was in the book. Because I think it's readers who actually create books, not writers. And reading's ever a more creative act than writing. And if you just suggest things, readers then discover not you, not literary influences, but they discover their own worlds, their own lives. And in that way, books are made and books continue to live.
You actually have a beautiful passage about reading and readers towards the end. And I have questions on that for you, Richard. But I kind of want to come back to the literary influences, because the title of the work, Question 7, is a reference to Chekhov, a literary great. So for those in the audience, I would like to interrogate or maybe explain, you know, what Question 7 is and why it is that kind of, it almost holds the, it holds the work together by being unanswerable. Can you talk to Question 7?
Well, Chekhov's one of my favourite writers, and many years ago I came across a book of his earlier stories, which are little known, because they were just sketches that he knocked out to make money, and they were comic sketches, and he wrote them to support himself as a student and to support his family. And one of them was just a series of those mental arithmetic questions you get asked to do at school. And question 7 in this list of questions goes something like this. May 31, a train leaves Station A at 3 a.m. and is to arrive at Station B at 11 p.m. Just before the train is about to leave, the order comes that it must be at Station B at 5 p.m. Who loves longer, a man or a woman? That's question 7. So it's three sentences, and it's a joke. It's an absurdist joke. And yet within it, implicit within it, is the future genius of Chekhov, because in his beautiful stories, you start with something that's seemingly very realistic, you know, a woman sitting at a dinner table, a man riding a troika through St. Petersburg, and then at some moment, the story flips with, and these people are beset by the everyday problems we all have. But somewhere in the story, and it's always mysterious in a Chekhov story, there's this sort of non sequitur where the story flips and we've gone to the secret world, not our public worlds where we are concerned about our jobs and getting from A to B and all the practical problems we have, but about the things that really concern our hearts and souls, about who loves longer, why we love, how to live. And during those long dark years of COVID, I realised I'd grown old, and like many people coming out of COVID, I began to wonder what it is to live, not simply to exist, but how to live. And I think this is a question that concerned so many people, and you see it in everything from the Great Resignation in the West to the Lie Flat movement in China to people leaving the city and an idea of one sort of life to go to live in the regions in search of a different sort of life. And I wanted to, you know, look at that question of what it is to live. And in a sense, that's what the book's about. And I often thought about my father when he returned from the war. So my father was a prisoner of war for the best part of 4 years. And at the end, he found himself a slave labourer working in a coal mine that ran under the inland sea in Japan. And he was 80 miles from Hiroshima when the bomb was dropped. And my father at that point told me many years later he was ready to die, that he'd given up hope and he knew he wouldn't last another winter. And at that point, the war was set to drag out for another year, and my father would have perished. Instead, and it is the great irony of my life that I've long been aware of, the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, tens of thousands of people died in that great crime, and then a few days later the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki and more tens of thousands of innocent people were slaughtered there. And because of those crimes, my father lived. 15 years later, I was born in a little country town in Tasmania. And later on, much later on, I wrote this book, and now you're all here tonight listening to me talk about it. And that in a sense, is where I come from, that bomb. And I began to wonder about the bomb and why the bomb. You know, why was it dropped there and where did it come from? And what I discovered is that the bomb doesn't really arise, as we're so often told, from a history of scientific progress. the bomb actually begins with a kiss in front of a bookcase in an Edwardian drawing room in 1911, when a 42-year-old writer called H.G. Wells, who was then one of the most famous writers in the world, above all for his invention of a new genre, which we now know as science fiction, kissed an 18-year-old rising woman writer of quite a brilliant disposition called Rebecca West. Wells was a proponent of free love. He was a womaniser, but he was really terrified of love. And Rebecca West didn't just want sex, she wanted love, she wanted the whole package. And this terrified Wells. It so terrified him that he wrote to Rebecca West, cutting off any further possibility of a relationship, and he fled to his mistress's chalet in Switzerland, where he wrote a book which was about a fire that consumes the world, because Rebecca West wrote to him about how he was frightened by the fire of her love. And he, in Switzerland, invents this new weapon of mass destruction, which is actually founded in the reality of scientific research at the time, because Wells actually had trained as a scientist and was well read in the latest scientific literature. And he called this weapon, that was the size of a pineapple and could destroy whole cities, the atomic bomb. And that's that atomic bomb, he actually recognised in the research of the scientists the extraordinarily destructive possibilities of their discoveries in Edwardian England long before the scientists themselves had. The book was a terrible book. The Times Literary Supplement described reading it as like trudging through porridge. And the book was quickly forgotten. Wells reunited with Rebecca West. They had a child. Years passed. But the idea of the atomic bomb remained resonant with some prominent people. Well, Winston Churchill was one. But another was a young Hungarian refugee called Leo Szilard, who in 1933 had just read Wells's The World Set Free, this novel about the invention of the atomic bomb. And he'd heard about a lecture the great nuclear physicist Ernest Rutherford had given, in which he dismissed any talk of energy or power or weaponry being devised from the splitting of the atom was just complete, in Rutherford's words, moonshine, and it was an impossibility. And that was the received wisdom in nuclear physics at the time. But Szilard, who was both a student and friend of Einstein's, didn't accept this, and he didn't accept it because he was haunted by Wells's book, and he thought and thought about all that Rutherford didn't know. And he'd fled Berlin to London, and it was standing at the Southampton Road traffic lights in Russell Square in London, looking at the lights change from red to green, that he suddenly had this vision that was at once terrifying and absolute, in which fiction and physics, science and literature, the past and the present and the future all came together. And he came up with the theory of the nuclear chain reaction, which was the whole basis on which the atomic bomb would be developed. And he acknowledged again and again that his inspiration for this was a novel by H.G. Wells. Jump cut 6 years. By 1939, Szilard has become so terrified by the possibility that Nazi Germany will develop an atomic bomb that he goes to Einstein, and together they petition Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the President of the United States, to begin a program to develop an atomic bomb. That leads to the Manhattan Project and ultimately to the atomic bomb being dropped 80 miles from where my father worked naked beneath the inland sea of Japan, and then 15 years later to my birth. So it's often said that poetry, well, Auden famously wrote in his beautiful elegy for W.B. Yeats in 1936 that poetry makes nothing happen, and that's often quoted about the irrelevance of literature. But a novel destroyed Hiroshima, and in a sense, I'm the progeny of that novel.
That got quite the reaction. Question 7 as a work, as a text, And also how you just articulated it, Richard, is one of the most profound articulations of the power of words and the power of literature that I have come across. And when we think back to all the works that Wells put out there, War of the Worlds, everything, he influenced people. And Richard, I think it's safe to say that you influence people, your fiction, your nonfiction, all of your work. And given the power of some books and some words and some ideas that are presented in fiction, do you feel a responsibility with the ideas that you put out in the world that may very well influence someone?
Well, I feel a responsibility to the truth. I think it matters when you write, certainly when you write journalism or, you know, history or these sort of things, you journey outwards from yourself, and you must describe what you see and touch and feel as accurately as you can. And you should be clear when you make commentary on it, what's commentary and what's description. I think there is a strong reason why the truth is repressed again and again in so many spheres of our life, because I think people have a hunger for the truth that's as real as their hunger for food or for love. And like food and love, they instinctively know the truth when they're presented with it. I think in our country, we've always been unknown to ourselves. We've been deceitful about ourselves all our history because we've always refused to acknowledge the great violence of our origins. And so we're very uncomfortable with our artists here, because an artist doing their job properly rubs against the grain to reveal the truth. I feel a responsibility for the truth in that sense. But there is another form of truth that story reveals, and the invention of story. And that truth is about the mystery at the heart of us. And that sort of truth doesn't propose answers. It just reflects the strange chaos and mystery of who we are back to us in a way that hopefully reminds us that we're not alone, that both in our worst aspects and our best, we share things with other people. And Chekhov, he was once asked what he thought of Tolstoy's greatest novel, Anna Karenina, and he replied, "It frames the question correctly." And that for Chekhov was the greatest compliment. And I think when fiction does its job properly, it's not like politics, it's not like philosophy or psychology or religion or science. It doesn't pretend to have answers, but if it does its job properly, it frames the questions correctly. And it is for the reader then to think about those questions and draw their own conclusions based on their own experiences of what life is, that chaos and that confusion and that strange mystery.
Question 7 is all about strange mystery. It is also very personal to you and your family, your parents, and Richard has agreed to do a short reading.
Thank you, Astrid. So the book, in another way, as I said, I want it to contain many things, but at its heart, it's really a homage to my mother and father and my island home. Now, this is a passage about my mother and father. My mother and my father. My mother and my father, different as they were, he with his reserve, she with her passion, he with his distance, she with her engagement. My mother and father, born to poverty and grateful to the point of astonishment that their children had all lived, that they did not want for food and knew pain only rarely, fully accepted the unequal terms on which the world had come to them, for they were alive and lived. On only one matter would they not budge, the inviolability of their souls that they somehow kept beyond corruption. My illiterate grandfather understood something fundamental. "If you don't have principles," he once told my father, "you may as well jump off the end of the jetty." Inscribe that above every parliament and boardroom entrance. "Crayfish to no man," Tom, my father's brother and a labourer all his life, once said. Tattoo that on every politician and journalist's forehead. Tom died playing darts in the St. Leonard's Hotel. Great Uncle Babes used to play piano at the St. Leonard's Hotel as well as at Mardwire's brothel. One night there was a brawl when his songbook was torn in the melee and scattered over the floor. Babes, because he was the 13th of 13 children, well-primed himself, grabbed random pages off the floor and continued playing seamlessly, passing from Home on the Range on the ripped left-hand page to Beautiful Dreamer on the torn right without missing a single note. My mother and father had a similar gift of stitching together torn fragments into some harmony amidst the melee of daily life. My mother and my father, in their stories and jokes, in their generosity and kindness to others, asserted the necessary illusion their lives might mean something in the endless tumult of this meaningless universe. For them to live, love had to exist. The love they valued above all things. They lived that love, and they fought for that love, and they defended that love. With the passing of time, this illusion became their hard-won truth. It was a form of magic, and they the magicians. In my vanity, I'd always thought of them as naive. Only now, writing these words, do I finally see the naivety was all mine. Thank you. Thank you.
It's an unanswerable question, and that feels kind of appropriate to ask you about question 7. But how do you think your parents would feel about this book? I know they have passed, and the reason why I ask is I was struck by a quote that you wrote about your dad in a different passage of the book. It was about books. And you wrote, "I have always felt slightly ashamed of my books, for I sensed they, and me with them, had somehow disappointed him." And that was in reference to your bookshelf and wide reading.
It was not the books I'd written.
Your bookshelf.
It was the, you know, as a writer, the thing, you know, when I was young, to have books. In Mum and Dad's home, we were library people, so many people once were. There was one little bookshelf, you know, waist high, three shelves that had some photo albums and a handful of books. That was it. And we went to the library and... my father came to my house one day and he saw my bookcases with all the books I had. And he asked me, why did I have so many books? Couldn't I use the library? And that's when I felt ashamed, because in a sense, he was right. He had no interest in material things. He had no interest in achievements of the conventional type. What mattered to him was that people were kind and good to each other. That idea of love that I talked about in that extract I read was for him and my mother closely allied to ideas of kindness and goodness. So after I wrote my first novel, my mother said to me, well, my mother was a woman of quite large ambition for her children, but she hoped I'd make a good plumber. It was that sort of world, you know, and... although as I write in the book, I wanted to be a writer from before I could write. I didn't dare tell my parents till I was 27, because I already had children and I knew they would, and they were, concerned about how I'd look after my family. And what mattered to them was being a good father and a good husband, and the rest was irrelevant. So after I'd written my first novel, and it's very hard when you write your first book because you don't know if it is the most monstrous vanity, and a lot of the rest of your life has to slip in order to undertake that immense labour. And no one can know if that book is good or bad, or if you can write or not, and least of all yourself, unless you're the most depraved ego. Luckily, fortune shined on me and the book was published, and it met with small good favour. And after it came out, my mother said, "Well, you've had your fun. Now you need to find a job." But I think I write in there, there's no memory without shame, because she was right. You know, it was a difficult path, and once you have children, that has to be your primary duty. And it was, to an extent, an irresponsible path, because no one can ever say to we were talking out the back, our writing isn't a career. You know, if you're very lucky in writing, very occasionally the sun shines on you, but for most of your writing life you'll be in the shadow. That's the story of all those writers we love. You know, it's a very difficult path. So in that world where my parents were concerned above all with kindness and goodness, much as they were, the written word mattered to them, it had to be secondary to those things.
You just led so well into my question about reading. Richard, I have another quote for you, and it kind of riffs off what you just said. You write in question 7, "Of the many necessary illusions that enable a writer to write, 2 are paramount. 1, the vanity they can write a good book, and the other, the conceit that a good book will be read by good readers, people with the insight to recognise what is good within it." Everybody here is here because of you, Richard, and because we like to read your books. I suspect that everybody here would like to think of themselves as a good reader and a good reader of your work. But I'm interested in kind of how you think of us. What makes us good readers, even though you will never meet most of us? We sit alone at home with your work. What do you think we're doing? Or what impact do you want on us?
Well, above all, I want you to enjoy it, I would hope, you know. I hope it would bring pleasure, but I think, paradoxically, a book survives to the extent it's misunderstood. You know, I never know why writers wish their work to be understood. The intentions and ambitions that writers set out with to write a book are the least interesting thing you can know about the book. Once I started being published as a writer and then started travelling Australia and then the world with my books, was to discover that they meant so many extraordinary things to people who clearly were extraordinary themselves, none of which I'd ever intended. It's quite disorienting to discover that what makes books, what brings books alive, are not your words, but the extent to which a reader grants it the authority of their soul and their history and their life. And if readers show your books that grace, then they live and they continue to live. And I've had many beautiful experiences that moved me deeply. There was a Moroccan Berber woman came to Tasmania recently who lives in France and is writing a doctorate on my work, because she first read them in Morocco and found them deeply resonant with her Berber world there. Now, it makes no sense why it would. And yet, you know, I like Russian novels from the 19th century, and I feel like they were written just for me today in the 21st century in Hobart, Tasmania. So they're the illusions, the necessary illusions that we love. I think literature, it is, as that noted literato, Marilyn Monroe, once said, "I don't fool men, I just let them fool themselves."
Well said, Marilyn Monroe.
I think it is a beautiful, I mean, seriously, you really do learn, and it's made me a better writer listening to my readers. Because the less you tell the reader what to think in your stories, the more you just lay it out, the more they will decide what the story is. And sometimes I think there are, and this idea of good readers and bad readers, because I talk in the book in question 7 about my father. Although he was very well read in poetry, in his dotage, his reading was principally 2 newspapers of despairing quality, the Launceston Examiner and the Hobart Mercury. And he would read these cover to cover, and in them he would find the vast cosmic tragicomedy of all humanity. And he would have these excerpts from, you would go over there and you'd want to read something from an in memoriam column or a football report or, you know, some very small local incident, because he was a wonderful reader and he found these things and they amused him, they moved him. And he once said there was more wisdom in a Mercury in memoriam column than there was to be had in a book of poetry. That's because he was a very good reader. And I was so taken with this that I was going to write a novel at one point that was about a really bad novelist who just happened to have some good readers who found and who wrote all these extraordinary articles about what the things they found in his work. And then the writer dies and there's more brilliant readings and the writer becomes elevated as the greatest writer in the nation's history. And then all his banal and hapless phrases actually become cornerstones of the national language simply because of good readers, you know. I think we can even look at our own history and see examples of this if we were to dwell upon it long enough.
So selfishly, I would like you to write that book. I think that would be a fascinating comment on contemporary publishing, not yours, by the way, Richard. This work does really share a great deal of your parents and the life that they gave you and your family. You also go back further in time. You go to your maternal grandmother, called Mate. And through your reflections on her experience and how she lived with you and your parents, you also start to, interrogate the, you know, last 250 odd years of Australian history and specifically Tasmania. And you mentioned it earlier, the great silences in our public discourse, the great silences in our literature, and you open up these questions for the reader through your own family and through just the idea of living in Tasmania and loving Tasmania and what does that mean now in the 21st century. And I wanted to ask you, Richard, and I know you gave an address earlier this year at Sydney Writers Festival, but, you know, less than a month after The Voice, I do want to ask, what is the role of literature, including question 7, in truth-telling in Australia at the moment?
Well, we went from Mate to the referendum.
Look, it was a stretch, but that's
I'm just trying to.
That's where my reading went. I'm so sorry.
I'm just thinking how to frame an adequate response. My Mate was like a character out of Tennessee Williams.
She's very exciting to read.
She was a woman of innumerable pretensions and even more hat boxes. And she lived with us. And her greatest pretense was that she was a free settler stock. For some reason, I always got on with her well, because I love listening to her stories. And as she neared her end, she one day told me that she thought her grandfather, whom she spoke often, may have been a convict. And you have to understand about Tasmania that for a quarter of its history, it really is the issue of two things. It's the issue of a genocide and of a slavery system that today we call convictism. And for a quarter of its history, it was this totalitarian state that ran a slave society and nearly successfully executed a complete genocide. For her to admit that we had any connection with this huge trauma was extraordinary. My younger sister went to the archives and discovered, of course, that he was a convict. Not only a convict, he was a political prisoner. He'd been a member of an Irish secret society, the White Boys, and been sentenced for white boyism, as it was called. And then we started discovering all sorts of convicts everywhere. We weren't free settler people at all. We were convict people. And in Tasmania, there was always this extraordinary memory. I remember as a young man, you couldn't bring a girl home without gossip about their great-grandparents. So there was a certain sort of memory one way, but there was nothing about these extraordinary traumas. And then in the book, I recount how after my father died, my sister discovered in his desk, amongst other correspondence, a letter from a deceased cousin in which she talked about how in my grandmother's family they'd been told never ever to talk about the fact they were black outside of the house. And we don't know if this story is true or not. It would explain a lot about my father if we were, and I talk about that in the book. But in a sense, I think it points to something else, which is which I also go on to discuss in the book. And that is, I think, culturally, whatever the truth of these stories, there wasn't just... We tend to repeat this lie, whether we're on the left or the right, that after the invasion, everything about a 65,000-year-old culture was destroyed, except in some very remote parts of Australia. But the culture was destroyed and obliterated and vanished. And I don't think, on the evidence that I see in Tasmania, from my own personal history, that this is the case at all. I think there was an equal process of indigenisation, the many, many ways in which the invaders met the invaded, and in the merge, something new happened. And we became not a European people, and nor are we an Asian people. We're something else, we're something different. And that indigeneity is strong within our mentality, the way we think about so many things. Our culture is different because of it. It doesn't make us indigenous, but it makes us different. And I think it points to the way in which, if we would open up fully to Indigenous Australia, if we would open up to the possibilities, to the wealth of that 65,000-year-old experience and the largeness of it, we could become an utterly extraordinary country. And I don't feel, and I do not believe, that the referendum result was the end of anything. I believe it was the beginning of something, and I believe there is a river of goodwill, of understanding that we are different because of Indigenous Australia, because of the possibilities it offers us. And that river did not end with that referendum vote, and that river is only going to grow bigger, wider, stronger, and the day will come when we will reach the sea of being a truly free and honest country.
I believe you, Richard, and I look forward to that day. I have no idea what this discussion is like for you in the audience, but question seven loops back around all of these questions constantly. There is no linear narrative. We go from Hiroshima to your parents, to H.G. Wells, to Tasmania, interwoven throughout. And your grandmother, mate, and what you just shared, your family's history, actually brings us back to H.G. Wells, which is kind of where we began this discussion, and his earlier work that was famous, The War of the Worlds. As you discuss in question seven, The War of the Worlds, you know, refers to Tasmania and the genocide in Tasmania. And I wanted to kind of ask you, Richard, about all of these looping intricacies in the work. It must have been really difficult to write, but also the experience of reading it, literally going from Hiroshima to Tasmania to, you know, your parents, sometimes between pages. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, I wanted the book to have an encantatory sort of feel and a musical feel to the prose. But I grew up in a world where time was circular. And the stories I grew up with, you know, sitting under the kitchen table when there's all these other kids and uncles and aunts, because we were a clan, a mob, and all these different people coming through the house, and the stories they told one another were always circular. They didn't progress in a linear way. They went back into the past and into the future, and they digressed. That's how I understood stories, and that's how I understood time. And only later, when I went to Oxford to study as a historian, did I discover that there is this other idea of time, the European idea of time, which is linear, which proceeds like a train track, stopping at all stations of human development and thought. And it makes sense in Europe, it makes sense in America, but it doesn't make sense here. And in the writing of this, as I discussed at that closing address at the Sydney Writers' Festival, I was sent this extraordinary essay by a young Yolngu woman called Sienna Stubbs. And it is about how in the Yolngu language there is a fourth tense. So we have three tenses, past, present and future. And they have this fourth tense, which is when something happens now, it's also simultaneously happening in the past and in the future. And Sienna uses this example in her essay of making fish traps. So when you go to make fish traps on the beach up there in northeast Arnhem Land, you're also simultaneously making it with your ancestors 1,000 years ago, and you're making it with your descendants 1,000 years hence. And I found this idea at once completely astonishing and utterly familiar, because it accorded with the way I'd been brought up to understand the world. And when you think about it, it is such a liberating idea, because it creates a sense of responsibility to our past, but also a sense of responsibility for our future. It places us on the earth on which we tread. It also is a comfort, because it proposes really that we don't simply live in this short fragment of time, but that we, by showing some humility to this idea of circular time, we have an existence that transcends our physical bodies. So I find it a very beautiful idea and a powerful idea, and I've written this book really seeking to use those ideas of the fourth tense, because, you know, we often think of Alzheimer's as the most tragic of diseases. Well, what really happens is people lose their past. That's what they lose. They lose their memory, which is their past. This book was trying to connect all the different pasts that are my present and will also be my future.
Richard, towards the end of question 7, you share something from your past with us. The time you almost died on the Franklin River. I'm not asking you to talk about that, but it's a gift. For those who read question 7, you are sharing that experience, and it is a gift to us as readers. And my final question to you is, why give us that gift? What was the impulse to share that with us?
Because I knew from the beginning it was necessary to make sense of the book, because my struggle after that experience, and not my struggle, it was the recognition, the knowledge I gained from it, was that really I lived in a dream, that all that was real to me was that time trapped in that river, in that darkness underwater for so many hours, and that I know one day I'll return to that reality, and all that time between is simply a dream, and what matters in that dream are the people I love and who love me, and the marvel of this world, and the great joy and wonder that it gives me every day. That was the point of including it.
Richard, thank you for question 7. Thank you for your generous answers. Can we have a round of applause for Richard?
You've been listening to Astrid Edwards in conversation with Richard Flanagan. It was recorded on Thursday, the 9th of November, 2023, at the Capitol, presented in partnership with RMIT Culture. The official bookseller was Readings.
The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.